This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We're the best entertained and least informed people on the face of the earth, and we cannot keep our international leadership or our democracy if we don't have an informed public that is capable of recognizing all the milestones of tyranny and telling the truth from fiction.
Coming up on Radio EcoShock, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. lays out the black truth about fossil fuels and his vision of a new energy economy. I'm Alex Smith. The team of hurricanes and tropical storms that worked up the East Coast set a bunch of records. Binghamton, New York had an extreme rainfall event higher than ever recorded. The whole Susquehanna River Valley flooded all the way down Pennsylvania down into Maryland. Spring floods? Sure, we expect that. Now we have fall floods? A couple of weeks ago, it was wet, wet, wet all around the D.C. area, as you know. As the chief meteorologist for the Capital Weather Gang reported, the rain in the first and second week of September was just off the charts. How about September 8th, when Fort Belvoir, the Army base in Fairfax County, Virginia, the National Weather Service reported 7 inches of rain there in 3 hours. Quote, it was off the charts above a 1,000-year rainfall based on the precipitation frequency measured from Quantico. End quote. There was a 1 in 50 or 100-year rainfall near Ellicott City, Maryland, 5.47 inches in 3 hours near Franconia in Virginia, a 1 in 500-year rainfall event there. The whole D.C. Baltimore metro area rainfall hit levels that might be expected every 10 to 25 years. Joe Rome at Climate Progress reminds us it's been a terrible year for extreme rainfall this year. Think about Nashville's Katrina, the 1-in-1,000-year crazy flooding there, and coastal North Carolina experienced a second 500-year rainfall in just the last 11 years. And what about that deadly flood that hit Queensland, Australia in January 2011 after a long, long drought? People, cars, and buildings were washed away.
As unusually severe weather continues to cause chaos across the east coast of Australia. Thousands of acres of land underwater, farms and their cattle stranded, and all in a country that just a few months ago was suffering from its driest summer on record.
Yeah, we just couldn't get out. Just everywhere we turned, just blocked off by water. Just torrents of water everywhere.
I've never ever seen water like this. I've never seen cars floating down Hunter Street before.
They are called extreme precipitation events. We have changed the atmosphere. Globally warmer air now holds 4% more water vapor than in just 1970. That doesn't sound like much until it falls on your head and your home. If the local weather is cold enough, the extreme moisture falls as snow. Not that anybody in Washington would remember last winter's unusually heavy dump. Only the idiots who deny climate science thought it was a sure sign of global cooling. Coming up, we'll hear about another huge rain disaster in Pakistan, dengue fever panic, and how that tropical disease is coming to America thanks to climate change. But first, a little blast from the past as Radio EcoShock reaches back to a program called The Unknown Climate on April 9, 2010, warning listeners about global wetting, the new hard rains predicted by science. In fact, as you'll hear, we asked American climate scientist Noah Diffenbaugh about the extreme precipitation way back in 2007. Maybe you saw Dr. Diffenbaugh on Al Gore's 24 Hours of Reality broadcast last week. And if you missed that, just go to climaterealityproject.org. You can find all our past programs where scientists, authors, and experts tell you what to expect in the coming times free at ecoshock.org. Help yourself to the downloads of MP3 shows there. Here's a clip from our April 2010 program.
Well, deadly flooding in Rio de Janeiro has raised questions about whether the city is equipped to host the 2016 Olympics. The floods triggered mudslides that killed at least 95 people.
Melbourne's main streets became raging torrents as the city was drenched by nearly 30 millimetres in less than 60 minutes.
Back here at home tonight, an update on the historic flooding that left parts of southern New England underwater this past week.
From Rhode Island to Rio to Queensland, 100-year floods, 200-year floods, all-time record rains happening all over the world, and as TV tells it, everyone is just a freak storm or the power of El Nino. The state of Rhode Island went underwater. The whole New England coast was pounded with days of record rains. When it stopped, the weather jerked into sudden summer heat. It's all part of the unknown climate. Who would have guessed? Maybe Radio EcoShock listeners 3 years ago, as I interviewed scientist Noah Diffenbaugh about extreme rainfall events.
And in 2005, your team released one of the most detailed climate model predictions for North America. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we found that elevated greenhouse gas concentrations substantially increase the frequency of extreme precipitation events, and also the contribution of those events to the total annual precipitation. So not only do the heaviest events become more frequent as greenhouse gas concentrations rise, but they also represent a larger fraction of the total precipitation that comes during the year.
Now that many Americans have been washed out and a few drowned by extreme rainfall, it's a good time to understand this underreported story coming out of Pakistan right now. And yes, there is plenty to learn about what can happen here. You remember the TV footage from 2010 when about one-fifth of Pakistan simply went underwater and stayed that way for over a month and more? Over 2,000 people died, and almost 20 million of the poorest people in the world were left homeless. Aid was difficult and slow. The country has not really recovered yet. There are still 800,000 people homeless from it. Now it is happening again, as monsoon rains pumped up by climate change have flooded the southern part of the country, the Sindh area, next door to India's Punjab. I didn't really hear about this one in the mainstream media. It broke into an email discussion I was having with the Radio EcoShock listener in Karachi, the port city at the very south of Pakistan. Thanks to the magic of podcasts and downloads, we have listeners from all over the world. Author and eco-activist Khalid Hassan wrote about a new documentary, the first green documentary released in Pakistan. It is called Murder of Mystic and shows another disaster, the fast-disappearing mangroves. As in most places of the world, the wealthy people and the top middle class want to build new houses on oceanfront. So they chop down the mangrove, what they call swamps, to create a clear view and maybe some beachfront. The land grabbers in Pakistan just hack down these low-lying trees with their many roots, which are the spawning grounds for loads of marine life, including the fish that support some of Pakistan's poorest fisher people. Mangroves also deflect the first signs of rising seas because they buffer the coast and help hold on to the coastline, keeping it intact during storm surges. A mangrove forest does a much better job than somebody's lawn and palatial home. The irony is, millionaires, who produce so much more carbon emissions than the rest of us flying around with their many homes, they'll lose all that valuable oceanfront first, as the sea rises. In the film Murder of Mystic by Outfield Productions, we also learn that mangroves are very tough to replace. After the real estate moguls hack it down, along come some well-meaning environment groups to replace them. There was even a contest in the Sindh area of Pakistan and nearby India to replant the most number of mangroves for the Guinness World Book of Records. Few of those plantings survived. The mangroves take years to establish themselves, and nature is complex. Mangrove forests cannot easily be replaced. The best way is to save what exists. But that kind of anti-real estate activism can be dangerous in Pakistan, as it is in many countries. We need to keep a careful eye on the safety of those who speak out. Find a few brief clips from The Murder of Mystic on YouTube. While Khalid and I discussed this, he wrote with amazing news. The streets of Karachi were flooding as never before. Sure, it's common for some flooding during monsoon season. They've seen that. We've seen that. But this was something else. The whole southern state of Sindh was just coming off a punishing 12-month drought. The monsoons were hoped for as a relief. Then on September 14th, rains beyond belief descended. Hundreds drowned. At least 2 million people are homeless in Sindh and Baluchistan provinces. The United Nations is again appealing for aid. And remember, those 800,000 people from last year's floods are still homeless and need help. Karachi, Pakistan's largest city, with somewhere around 25 million people, maybe in the greater metropolitan area. It was more or less shut down by flooding. The lights went out, the city stopped functioning, and then the refugees from the drowned rural areas all around came in their own human flood toward the city. Find the latest news at www.dawn.com. Pakistan's greatest weather and climate scientists have no doubt this latest extreme flooding is another result of climate change. We find this quote from an article September 18th by Mr. Waqar Bhatti. Rains in Sindh are the highest ever recorded monsoon rains during the 4 weeks period. Since this year received 270% and 1,170% above normal monsoon rains, respectively, in August and September, he said, adding that in just 4 weeks, the otherwise dry, arid region received rainfall which was close to what it got normally in 5 years. Though sometimes it is difficult to relate extreme weather events to climate change, if we look at the frequency and the trend of extreme weather events happening in Pakistan during the last two decades, it is easy to find its connection with climate change, said Dr. Komar Uzaman Chowdhury, Advisor Climate Affairs and Vice President of the World Meteorological Organization, Asia Region, on Thursday. Okay, so now the kicker which warns everyone of the many nasty side effects of climate change. Dengue fever has hit the flood victims of Pakistan. You may not know about dengue fever, but this formerly tropical disease is hovering around the southern United States. There have been 12 cases this year in Florida alone and a few more in Texas. The Bahamas has an outbreak of dengue fever right now. If you need a dose of celebrity news, singer Rihanna's father was just hospitalized with dengue fever, picked up at Rihanna's home in Barbados. On September 15th, the Los Angeles Times reported the tropical mosquito that carries dengue fever and malaria was found in the San Gabriel Valley right near Los Angeles, California. You may want to take a minute to learn to recognize this bug. The scientific name is Aedes albopictus. Most people call it the Asian tiger mosquito. It's a tiger because the more you swat it, the more it attacks. And this one bites in the middle of the day, not in the early morning or evening as most North American mosquitoes do. Those are the two signs, aggressive and bites in the daytime. This insect is easy to identify. It is a smaller mosquito, but the legs and body are black with white patches or stripes. If you see little white markings on the legs of a mosquito, you've found it. In the recent Pakistan floods in Karachi and all around, extending even to Lahore, there is panic now that dengue fever has set in. That's a disease you want to learn about as our climate heats up. Dengue fever has been called bone break fever. It hits very hard. People feel like they are dying, so they flock towards medical help, towards the hospitals. Here is a news clip from Al Jazeera, September 15th, on the dengue panic in Pakistan.
Hundreds of people make a beeline to a government hospital to get their blood tested. This woman has high fever, a common symptom besides headache and nausea. And even though she may be fearing for her life, doctors say the mortality rate from the dengue virus is less than 1%. Lack of awareness and fear-mongering has led to nothing short of panic. A media hype about the dangers of the disease and a politicization of the issue has led people to panic. They're now congregating at the hospitals, putting a severe strain on the hospital systems.
If a dengue test is not positive,
Dr. Salahuddin Khan is in charge of the dengue control program at Jinnah Hospital in Lahore and says they have even turned their conference rooms into dengue wards. He says there is now a gradual understanding of this mysterious virus.
As the time is passing, the panic is subsiding. I wouldn't call it a real panic, but I would say that there was some semblance of a panicky situation for some people, not knowing too much about the disease, or perhaps fear creeps in. So, but the situation in the hospital is totally under control.
The doctor said that out of 4,000 tests, only 17 turned positive, squashing rumors that thousands had died from dengue fever. The hospital is full of patients, and even the corridors are now makeshift wards to deal with the crisis.
Part of the point is most victims do not die of dengue fever, and they think they have it when they don't. Although you can die, most people survive after that violent illness. Keeping hydrated, lowering the temperature with aspirin or Tylenol or cooling baths, that is the treatment. But we can expect a similar panic if dengue fever breaks out for real in North America or even Southern Europe, where people are fearful of this unknown tropical disease. If there are mosquitoes in the hospital itself, as happens in some less developed countries, then those flocking to hospitals may be at greater risk. dengue fever is transferred by mosquito bites and cannot otherwise pass from person to person. Close the windows or put up screens, and you are safe to treat your loved one who has dengue fever. Learn to recognize the mosquito and the disease and avoid panic. The real solution is to limit the amount of climate change we cause. Maybe we can prevent tropical bugs and their diseases from arriving. That is our goal at Radio EcoShock, to prevent as much as we can climate change. I'm Alex Smith. Did you know your body is already toxic with mercury from coal plants? And why doesn't the media tell you the truth about climate change? Get ready for a blockbuster speech from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., courtesy of the Climate One Project at the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Flick on a light switch in the United States, and chances are you'll be poking your finger into a coal mine somewhere in the country. About half of the nation's electricity is supplied by coal, thanks in part to policies from the 1970s that favor the abundant American source of energy. But coal is also among the dirtiest fossil fuels and a major source of carbon pollution that is driving global weirding. Should the United States move away from coal to cleaner power? Should it make coal itself cleaner? One of coal's biggest critics is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., noted author, attorney, and environmental advocate. He's featured in the new documentary film, The Last Mountain, which depicts the lives of people in the coal mining towns of Appalachia. For the next hour, Mr. Kennedy and our live audience in San Francisco will discuss the extraction and combustion of coal, as well as broader national energy issues. So please welcome Robert F. Kennedy to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you for coming. So a lot of the preference for coal goes back to the 1970s when American policies sort of gave deliberate preference to a U.S. source of energy. A lot of presidents have promised energy independence. They haven't delivered it yet. What do you think America should do for a comprehensive national energy policy?
Well, you know, for 27 years, I've been an environmental advocate for 27 years, and for 27 years I've had the same answer to that question, which is free market capitalism. People say to me, what's the most important environmental law that we could pass? And I would say, I've always said the same thing. It's free market capitalism, because in a true free market promotes efficiency. And efficiency means the elimination of waste. And pollution is waste. And a true free market would encourage us to properly value our natural resources. And it is the undervaluation of those resources that causes us to use them wastefully. But in a true free market, you can't make yourself rich without making your neighbors rich and without enriching your community. But what polluters do is they make themselves rich by making everybody else poor. They raise standards of living for themselves by lowering quality of life for everybody else. And they do that by escaping the discipline of the free market. You show me a polluter, I'll show you a subsidy. I'll show you a fat cat using political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay his production costs. And coal claims to be cheap, but actually it's probably the most catastrophically expensive way to boil a pot of water that has ever been devised. If you know, I spend a lot of time in West Virginia over the past 2.5 decades. I had a 6.5 week jury trial in West Virginia about a year and a half ago, and I won the biggest judgment in the history of the state. I was back in the state about 3 months ago arguing the appeal of that judgment before the West Virginia Supreme Court. And as I was leaving the state, I was driving on a highway that felt like I was driving on a cushion. It was so soft, and it was almost like a skateboard park. And that's very unusual in West Virginia. West Virginia is the 49th poorest state. My father used to say, you know, coal claims to be bringing prosperity to this state, but it's got a state with the richest resources in our country, but it has the 49th poorest people. And coal has brought poverty and destruction and a disability and dysfunction to this state, not prosperity. But good roads are hard to find in West Virginia. And I asked the driver, why does it feel like we're driving on a cushion? He said, because there's 22 inches of asphalt on this road. And the reason I knew there was, why the Massachusetts Turnpike has 4 to 6 inches, the New York State Thruway is 6 to 8 inches, every inch of asphalt. cost the taxpayer millions of dollars. And yet, and I knew the reason they had 22 inches of asphalt, because the coal trucks weigh 90,000 pounds and they'll pulverize less robust roads. So when coal says that, the coal industry is not paying for that 22 inches of asphalt, and that road has to be repaired every 4 years, whereas a regular highway has to be repaired every 20 years. So, and it's not the coal industry that's paying that bill. It's you and I, the taxpayer. So coal says it's cheap. They say we're only 11 cents a kilowatt hour. But they're not telling you you're also paying for that, those 3,000 miles of coal roads in West Virginia. That's coming out of a different pocket. Last year, the National Academy of Sciences said that a 10-year study they completed that showed that every single freshwater fish in America now has dangerous levels of mercury in its flesh. That mercury is coming from coal-burning power plants. One out of every six American women now have so much mercury in her womb from eating those fish and from other vectors that her children are at a grim risk for a grim inventory of diseases: autism, blindness, mental retardation, heart, liver, and kidney disease. I have so much mercury in my body. I got my levels tested recently, and I fish a lot. I eat the fish. My levels are 10 times what EPA considers safe. And I was told by Dr. David Carpenter, who's the National Authority on Mercury Contamination, that a woman with my levels of mercury in her blood would have children with cognitive impairment, with permanent brain injury. Well, today, according to CDC, there are 647,000 children born in this country every year who've been exposed to dangerous levels of mercury in their mother's wombs. That's a cost on our country that they don't tell you about when they say, oh, it's only 11 cents a kilowatt hour. Last week, Harvard published a study, a peer-reviewed study by Paul Epstein, that showed the cost of coal from the cost of health impacts to our national health system just from ozone and particulates is $345 billion a year. And that's part of the cost of burning coal. 10 million asthma attacks a year, a million lost work days. I live 2 hours south of the Adirondack Mountains. This is the oldest protected wilderness on the face of the earth. Generations of Americans had the rightful expectation that they would be able to enjoy those landscapes unspoiled. But today, one-fifth of the lakes in the Adirondacks is sterilized, dead from acid rain, which has also destroyed the forest cover on the high peaks of the Appalachians from Georgia to northern Quebec. And those of you who see the movie will see what's happened, which is that this industry has, over the past 10 years, they've cut down the 500 biggest mountains in West Virginia. They've flattened an area of Appalachia larger than the state of Delaware. If you filled 25 feet of a Hudson River stream, we would put you in jail. If you blew up a mountain in the Sierras up here, or in Utah or Colorado or the Berkshires, or in Appalachia, you would go to jail or you'd be put someplace for the criminally insane. But in Appalachia, they're able to cut down 500 mountains, and it's all illegal. And they've been able to bury not 25 feet of streams, but 2,500 miles of rivers and streams. And they do it by subverting democracy. And by hiding what they're doing from the public. Because what they're doing is illegal. You saw me ask Bill Rainey, who's the head of the Coal Association, and I asked the same thing in a debate last year with the CEO of Massey Coal. I said to him, you've had, by your own records, 67,000 violations in 5 years and tens of thousands of violations of other mining and safety laws. Can you make a profit in your industry without breaking the law? And he said, no. He acknowledged he does operate a criminal enterprise. His business plan is to break the law and then to disable, to subvert democracy so that the law is not enforced against them. And that destruction of democracy is another cost of coal that they don't tell you about when they say it's only 11 cents a kilowatt hour. We give to the oil industry $1.3 trillion in subsidies every year. If you don't believe that figure, look at Terry Tamminen's new book, Lives Per Gallon, which Terry Tamminen just stepped down as head of California EPA. and he has meticulously and scrupulously inventoried the vast raft of subsidies that we give to oil every year. This is the richest industry in the history of the world. We borrow $1 billion a day in our country. People talk about, you know, the trade imbalance with China. Well, that's nothing compared to the trade imbalance with the oil countries. We borrow $1 billion a day mainly from nations that don't share our values in order to import $1 billion of oil a day. A lot, again, largely from nations that don't share our values. And this hemorrhage of $750 billion annually of American wealth has beggared a nation that when I was a little boy owned half the wealth on the face of the planet. Our deadly addiction to carbon is the principal drag on American capitalism.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California.
In last year in November, Lord David Putnam gave a speech before Parliament. When Parliament was debating a cap-and-trade system that's very similar, but actually much tougher than the one that we passed in Congress, and then that was defeated in the Senate, and it was the mainstay of President Obama's national energy policy. And to its credit, Parliament ultimately passed that bill. But there, in our country, half the people don't believe that global warming exists because of, and I was talking to somebody a few minutes ago, they said, why is that? Well, it's because the propaganda works. And Exxon and Koch brothers have spent $200 million, you know, erecting phony think tanks and filling them with these phony scientists who we call biostitutes. And you know, and employing these slick PR firms to persuade the American public that global warming doesn't exist, and propaganda works. Joseph Goebbels used to say, talk about the big lie. If you tell it again and again and again, ultimately people will believe it. And that's what's happening. But in Great Britain, they haven't experienced that. People generally accept the science. They understand that it's a grim reality that government has to take a strong hand in enforcing. And ultimately, Parliament passed the bill, but there's still vested interest in other people in England who said that, we have to move incrementally, we have to move slowly, because if we move precipitously, it's going to cause grave dislocations in the marketplace and our economy. That's going to impede our ability to address this and other issues, and it's going to be bad for our country. And Lord Putnam reminded Parliament that exactly 200 years before, the same body had debated the abolition of the slave trade. And at that time, everybody in England believed that slavery was an abomination, a moral catastrophe that had to be abolished. But people said, how do we do it? Because slavery represented 25% of the GNP of Great Britain. It was the principal source of energy for the entire British Empire. And they said, if we abolish it outright, the economy is going to crater. But after a year of debate, Parliament made the moral choice and abolished slavery literally overnight. And instead of collapsing, the British economy exploded as thousands of entrepreneurs rushed into that space to create new forms of energy, mainly mechanical ones, in an era that we now know as the Industrial Revolution, which was the greatest epic in wealth creation in the history of mankind. And the abolition of the slave trade had exposed all of these hidden inefficiencies that were associated with free human bondage. Well, today, we don't need to abolish carbon in this country in order to understand that our deadly addiction to it is the principal enemy to America's prosperity, to our leadership, to our national security, to the values that make us proud to be part of this country, to the historic role that my family always believed in of America as an exemplary nation. We do know this, that every nation that has decarbonized its society has experienced instantaneous wealth. Iceland in 1970 was the poorest country in Europe. It was 100% dependent on imported coal and oil. The government of Iceland, mainly because they were frightened of global warming, which impacts the northern latitudes disproportionately, decided to decarbonize their society. But again, you had vested interests in others who tried to hold back and impede that process. But the government moved very deliberately. And during that period, Iceland became 100% energy independent. So 95% of Iceland's electric grid now comes from local geothermal. And Iceland went from, during that 15-year period, from being the poorest country in Europe to being the fourth richest country by GDP on Earth.
You You are listening to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California, courtesy of the Climate One Project. Find out more at commonwealthclub.org.
Now, unfortunately for Iceland, they spent virtually all of their newfound wealth on bundled derivatives, and they are again the poorest country in Europe. But their economy is rebounding and will rebound because the fundamentals now are strong. Iceland is one of the world's great energy exporters. They can't run lines across the Atlantic because it's too far. They will be able to, incidentally, very soon because Great Britain is building under Gordon Brown's plan, these giant wind farms in the North Atlantic, and they're close enough to Iceland that they're going to be able to attach a DC grid line and then sell their energy directly to Europe, and they're going to be very, very wealthy. Well, right now, Iceland imports bauxite from Jamaica, uses the big surplus of geothermal to smelt the bauxite into aluminum, then sells the ingots on the world market, and that's their way of exporting energy. Sweden, in 1996, decided to decarbonize their society and shut down their nuclear power plants. They closed their two biggest nuke plants, slapped a $150 ton tax on carbon, and Sweden's economy since 1996 has grown by 45%, while its energy use has dropped by 9%. Brazil, 20 years ago, decarbonized its transportation grid, and as a direct result of that choice, Brazil, while the entire world economy spiraled and collapsed, Brazil continues to enjoy the longest, most robust economic expansion in the history of Latin America. I was talking to some friends tonight about the fact that Brazil this year will displace France as the fifth richest country on earth. Costa Rica, at the same time, decarbonized their electric grid. As a result of that choice, and Costa Rica made some other great choices too, like not having an army. And as a result of that, Costa Rica, which is the smallest country in Central America, is by far the wealthiest. Its economy is larger than most of its neighbors combined. You can go on and on with those examples. But we in our country have much greater geothermal resources than they have in Iceland. My home in Mount Kisco, New York, is powered by geothermal. Virtually every home outside of the major cities in our country could be. But almost nobody uses geothermal because of the illusion that geothermal is more expensive than the incumbents. It isn't. If you added the subsidies, it's far less expensive. But the market, the subsidies have distorted the market and sent the wrong signals to purchasers and consumers, so very few people use geothermal, which is far cheaper than oil and coal, and you know, it doesn't get us in wars in the Mideast and doesn't impose all these other costs in our society. We're the number one in the world for wind, the Great Plains states of the Saudi Arabia of wind. We have enough wind. In fact, North Dakota is the windiest place on earth at sea level. We have enough wind, according to a recent report by the Scientific American, in Montana, North Dakota, and Texas to provide 100% of the energy grid for the U.S. and Canada three times over, even if every American owns an electric car. We're number one or two in the world for solar. The Scientific American report showed that we could power the entire existing U.S. energy grid from an area of the desert southwest that's 75 miles by 75 miles, about 19% of the most barren desert land. I've been privileged to be an advisor to the current administration, the Obama administration on energy policy. All of the leaders of that administration, Stephen Chu, Ken Salazar, Lisa Jackson, and the others, want to transition us to a new energy economy. The barriers are these, and this is the answer to the long answer to your short question. Number one, the unfair advantage that the incumbents have because of the subsidies that are flowing to them, so we're not playing on a level playing field. Obama tried to correct that first by abolishing the subsidies, the direct subsidies, like the oil depletion allowance, which is $35 to $55 billion a year, and the waiver of royalties to the oil industry, and to address the indirect subsidies through the carbon tax. And, the cap and trade system, and that failed. But even with the subsidies, because of innovation, the cascading innovation that we're seeing in solar and wind, those renewables are now approaching parity with the incumbents, even with the huge advantage, unfair advantage they have in the marketplace. Number two, this is the most important, we don't have an energy grid in this country that can carry these new currents of energy. Our energy grid is antiquated, it was underbuilt, it is already overpowered, and it's misaligned. It doesn't reach the big wind centers in the Midwest, the solar centers in the desert southwest, and it is dumb. It's a dumb grid. and it does not, it's incapable of doing long-haul transmission of energy. Virtually every farmer in the state of North Dakota wants to put wind turbines on their property. And you have huge mountains of private capital. I'm on the board of the biggest green tech venture capital firm in the country, which is located right here in San Francisco, Vantage Point, and by far the most profitable. They're among the top performing venture capital firms in any discipline, in any space. So they want to go into North Dakota and build wind farms. And big players like Siemens and Vestas and General Electric and Warren Buffett and T. Boone Pickens all want to go there. There's huge piles of cash surrounding the state of North Dakota waiting to flow in and build turbines on every property. Every farmer in North Dakota wants to build the turbines. Why? A North Dakota cornfield is worth $800. If it's got a wind turbine on it, it's worth $3,000. We have the ability now to, with wind, to create prosperity in declining rural economies, to create jobs, and to enrich farmers and to allow them to hold on to their farms, which is a really critical part of democracy. The problem is the North Dakota wind farmer cannot get his product to market, the electrons to market, because the electrons will diffuse in our current lines before they cross the North Dakota border. So they can't reach Cincinnati or Cleveland, Columbus, St. Louis, New Orleans, or New York. And we need to build a grid system in our country, and the Obama administration is now doing this piece by piece, a unified national grid that will connect these the renewable power generation centers to the markets in our country. The same way that Eisenhower built a national highway system back in the 60s, we need to do that with the grid, and we need to build a smart grid. And yesterday, the headlines in many papers across the country were that Obama's going to make this one of his primary objectives between now and the election, to start implementing the smart grid in our country, and that's very, very encouraging. And the third issue, the impediment that they face, is that we have an arcane, we have a balkanized system where we have 50 public utility commissions in the 50 states, and 120 control districts, each with their own arcane and Byzantine set of rules that restrict access to the grid. What we need, what the Obama administration understands, is a unified national grid that acts as a marketplace where everybody, people like me, I produce far more energy than I use in my home. I ought to be able to sell that surplus onto the grid and make market rates for it. Today, there's very few places where you can do that. Every American ought to be able to do that. We need to create a national market where everybody can participate, one that democratizes our energy system in this country, rather than one that creates oligarchies. And the economic system, the political system reflects the economic system. And if you have an energy sector that's controlled by a couple of people, you ultimately are going to have a politics that is controlled by a couple of large corporations, which is not good for our country. We need to create a marketplace that does what a market is supposed to do, which is to reward efficiency, to reward good behavior, which is efficiency, and to punish bad behavior, which is inefficiency and waste. Right now, we have a marketplace that is governed by rules that were written by the incumbents, coal, oil, and nuke, to reward the dirtiest, filthiest, most poisonous, most destructive, most addictive fuels from hell, rather than the cheap, clean, green, wholesome, safe, and patriotic fuels from heaven. And we need to change that dynamic around.
So what are some... Our guest today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. I'm Greg Dalton. What are some specific policies that should be implemented that would level that playing field between incumbents and clean technologies?
Well, it's really about, like I said, about creating a market. And when you create that unified market, national market, you turn every American into an energy entrepreneur, every home into a power plant like mine, and we can power our country then, based upon American resourcefulness and entrepreneurship and what Franklin Roosevelt called American industrial genius, rather than Saudi Arabian oil. We've done this before. We built, all the great infrastructure in our country was built by government. That's the role of, one of the primary roles of government, the canal system, the road system, the highway system, the railroad system, the airline system, airports, were all built by the federal government. And then private entrepreneurs come and create wealth. But the infrastructure has to be built by government. So, in 1979, we built an ARPANET grid in this country, which was a grid for the Internet that connected every American home so everybody could participate in the Internet. a year later, and I actually watched a documentary on last night on TV about this. It was very interesting about the growth of the ARPANET. But a year later, in 1980, the CEO of IBM said that PCs, personal computers, were a dead-end technology. Okay? And a lot of other computer companies made that bet, like Dell and MCR and Honeywell, and they're out of the computer business because they just bet wrong, because they didn't see what the market was going to do to revolutionize computer technology and put it and democratize it, put it in the hands of everybody. Well, today, everybody, because we built that marketplace, everybody has a PC. And what happened to the cost of information? It plummeted to almost zero. In fact, I would say zero. One of the companies, you know, that VantagePoint has is a company called ChaCha. Has anybody here heard of it? Raise your hand if you've heard of it. See, it's just the young people.
Yeah.
So, anyway, ChaCha is a company that you dial on your cell phone, ChaCha, C-H-A-C-H-A. It's 247-247. Then you can ask any question that you want, and usually within a minute, they'll answer that question. It's free and free. They make their money by putting little advertisements while you wait. But it's free information forever. I was in China the other day, and I was showing this to some Chinese friends of mine, and I said, ask me any question. And they said, okay, what was Mao Zedong's favorite lunchtime meal? So I put it in there, and it comes back in 30 seconds, spicy brown bean soup over fried rice. You can ask anything. When is he going to stop talking? What's the meaning of life? Anything you want, and it'll try to answer it. So this is free information forever. And it happened because we built that grid. The same thing is going to happen to electrons as soon as we build a national grid for electricity. In 1996, we built a national grid for telecommunications. Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. He ordered all the baby bells to unify their lines and to lift all the restrictions so anybody could get onto the lines and sell their product. The lowest cost provider prevails in the marketplace. This spawned a telecommunications revolution in our country, and all these little gadgets that we have, like iPhones and stuff, are the offspring of that revolution. But what happened to the cost of telecommunications? Well, it plummeted to virtually zero. 2 days ago, I saw an advertisement, and these ads are ubiquitous on TV now, from a company called Vonage, that promises unlimited, overseas, long distance, and local calls for $14. That's practically free. Now, about 3 months ago, I called Miami, from Miami to London, and the call, for 5 minutes, the call cost me $74.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California.
That's the old way of doing things. The new way with the national grid is free telecommunications forever. The same thing is going to happen to electrons as soon as we build this national grid for electricity. Now,
how is a broke federal government going to invest this much money to build a national grid?
Well, you know, the grid itself is not going to cost that much. The grid itself, it will probably cost about $250 billion to build a smart grid that reaches most of America and that, you know, that can do the things that we need to do, like can send signals through the line, allow the utilities to send a signal through the line to turn off the hot water boilers in a million homes for 15 minutes in order to avoid the peak demand that is the most expensive part of our electrical system. If you eliminated peak, you save enough natural gas in our country to power the entire U.S. passenger car fleet. So, and we can do that just by using the grid smartly. A grid to send a signal to turn off all the electric toothbrush rechargers, to turn off your swimming pool recirculators, and all of these things. You don't care if somebody turns them off for 15 minutes, and you sign something. It can go into your car and borrow the stored electricity in your car. In your battery, whether you got a plug-in hybrid or a plug-in car. And so we need to build a smart grid. That costs very little. About 4 months of the Iraq war, we have a whole national grid in this country. Then to build the generation for that grid will cost about, and I can tell you this, and let me give you an example that shows you how. Right now, one of our portfolio companies is called BrightSource. And BrightSource is building the biggest power plant in America, which is in the Mojave Desert, and it's a solar thermal plant. This is not solar voltaic of the kind that your grandmother used to bolt to her roof. This is a mirror farm in the desert where they put a turbine on top of a tower, a giant scaffold, and they surround it by concentric rings of mirrors that are manipulated by computers to reflect sunlight onto that turbine. And 20 minutes after the sun comes up in the morning, that turbine's at 750 degrees Fahrenheit. So a very efficient way of generating energy. We're building this plant in 3 years. It takes 10 years to build a coal plant. We can build this in 3 years. It costs $3 billion a gigawatt to construct. That's the same price it costs to build a coal plant. It's one-fifth the price it costs to build a nuke plant. And once you build our plant, it's free energy forever. Because the photons are hitting the Earth for free every day. All we have to do is construct the infrastructure to pick them up and put them in the line. Once you build that coal plant, now you got to go to the Appalachians, cut down the mountains, ship them across the country on rail yards, warp every rail in this country so we can't have high-speed rail, burn the coal, poison every fish, kill 60,000 people a year, cause 10 million asthma attacks, you know, acidify the lakes and all the other costs. Once you build an oil plant for the same $3 billion, and remember, ours is then free, once you build that oil plant, now you got to go to Saudi Arabia, punch holes in the ground, bring up the oil, refine it expensively, genuflect to the sheiks who despise democracy and are hated by their own people, get in periodic wars that cost us $3 trillion, escorted across the Atlantic with a military escort that Exxon doesn't pay for, you and I do. Then you spill it all over the Gulf, spill it all over Valdez, burn the oil, and poison everybody in our country. And so the big costs occur after you build the plant. Once you build our plant, it's free energy forever.
John, okay, John Bullard, the CEO of that.
Let me finish this. He's talking too much. Let me just finish them. To answer your question to the math. Here's the math. We use 1,000 gigawatts in peak demand in our country. 500 of those, so that's what we got to replace. 500 of those are carbon-based. So that's what we really have to replace to have free energy. The others are nuke and hydro, et cetera, that are essentially free operation at this point. So 500 at 2% growth over the 50-year life of a power plant, you have to double that. But you can cut it back in half by conservation, by building codes and, you know, and appliances, what we call megawatts, which are the cheapest form of energy. So conservatively, we have 1,000 gigawatts to replace. At $3 billion a gigawatt, which is what wind and solar cost, that is about $3 trillion, which is less than the cost of the Iraq war. So for less than the cost of the Iraq war, we can have free energy forever in this country. And then what happens? That's the biggest tax break that has ever occurred, and it's permanent. Because the biggest cost to businesses and individuals in this country is our energy cost. And if you can eliminate those, which we can, then you suddenly have an advantage over the rest of the world in everything you produce, plus all the technological advantage that we get from incentivizing entrepreneurship and imagination and invention in order to construct and build this grid. And, you know, I'll just say this one final point, which is this, that in 1929, just in October, just before the stock market crashed, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was at 385. In 1942, the Dow Jones was at 85. So the big stimulus package that FDR passed that we now call the New Deal kept millions of Americans alive, millions of farmers on their farms, millions of Americans in their home, thousands of banks from folding, but it was not robust enough to restore the market economy. Then in 1940, President Roosevelt gave a famous speech, one of the most important speeches in our history to our country. He went on the radio and he said, World War II is on the horizon. Remember, Pearl Harbor was still a year away, but we were doing the Lend-Lease program with England. And he said, we're going to build 50,000 aircraft a year. His aides later admitted that he had torn that number out of thin air before he sat down 5 minutes before. The year before, we had built 2,800 aircraft in our country. He said, we're going to build 50,000. He said, we're going to build 25,000 tanks. We're going to build a ship a day, a battleship a month, an aircraft carrier every 3 months. We're going to do it every month until the war is over and won. People laughed at him. He was ridiculed by editorialists on the left and the right. They said, no industrial mobilization has occurred of this magnitude in history. He's bitten off more than he can chew. But Roosevelt went immediately out to Detroit. And he told the automakers, you're not building automobiles anymore. You're building aircraft, and you're building tanks and half-tracks and amphibious vehicles and bombs and detonators. Within 6 weeks, they had retooled their plants. Within 6 months, They had met his production goals. Within 12 months, they had surpassed them. The following year, we built 96,000 aircraft in this country. We had full employment. 160,000 women went to Detroit and found jobs where they'd been blackballed before with Rosie the Riveter. 200,000 blacks went to Detroit and found jobs where they'd been blackballed before. We had full employment. Everybody had cash in their pocket, and they began investing it in the marketplace again. And the market recovered, gave us a middle class, which gave us stability and prosperity for the next 50 years and made our country the envy of the world. And today, we have a huge advantage over Roosevelt, because Roosevelt was building stranded assets, planes and tanks and bombs that were being sent over to be blown up that had no lasting benefit to the American people. Today, we have the capacity to build infrastructure, pylons that stretch across the country with wires down the existing right-of-way and railroads to bring North Dakota wind to the markets in New York, etc., with DC lines that don't lose the electrons, to employ thousands of Americans erecting wind turbines on every farm in the Midwest, and millions more to bolt photovoltaics to every south and facing roof in America that wants them, and millions more to blow in cellulosic insulation to every home in America that wants those. And at the end of that, we have an infrastructure that will give us free energy forever. And then you have the entrepreneurs and the businesses take over and take advantage of this huge advantage that we now have. And that will give us prosperity and jobs. You know, we crossed a critical milestone this year. We built in this country more wind and solar last year than we did all the generation capacity, than all the incumbents combined. And that is a critical milestone in the adaptation of disruptive technologies. The year that you build more than of one than the other. It's like flat screen TVs 10 years ago, everybody said, it'll never happen. It cost $10,000 a piece. 5 years ago, for the first time, we sold more flat screen TVs than we did vacuum tube. This year, the last vacuum tube manufacturer closed down, right? That's how fast it can happen. Once you hit that tipping point, which is the year you produce more of the one form of the energy than the other, nobody notices it because the other one is so dominant in the marketplace. Nobody notices it. But that is the milestone that you look for when the disruption, the displacement is about to take place. And we've done that in our country. And we have, you know, this is going to happen because, not because government tells it, but because the market is going to drive it there. Because we can produce cars that cost 6 cents a mile over the life of the car to drive, electric cars, versus an internal combustion engine that costs 60 cents. How long can they maintain that? It's just not going to happen. And we can produce energy for free. And so they, you know, oil and coal and all these incumbents have a huge advantage now because they own Congress and they own the Senate. But the market ultimately is going to drive us there, and it's going to drive us there fast. We're at the tipping point now, and you're about to watch the cascade.
We're about to go to audience questions also and see if you can ask a question. You mentioned presidential leadership and your advisor to the Obama administration. The Los Angeles Times recently wrote an editorial saying that President Obama has been a bit of a disappointment on environment issues. He didn't deliver a climate bill. He has done some things on investing in light and high-speed rail and increased auto efficiency standards. How would you assess how well the Obama administration has done on energy so far?
Well, I would say that if the Obama administration did what it wanted to do, what President Obama wants it to do, that we would have done all the things that I just talked about. The problem is that our democracy is broken. The press is broken in this country. We have 30% of Americans now getting their information from talk radio, which is 95% controlled by the right. We have 22% getting their news from Fox News. And we have an oil, we have our campaign finance system, which is just a system of legalized bribery, has just been opened by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Citizens United case, which is the most disastrous opinion. You know, H.L. Mencken said that a journalist is somebody who can't distinguish between a bicycle accident and the end of civilization. Well, the Citizens United case is the end of civilization, the end of democracy. We have a 100-year-old law that said corporations cannot contribute to federal political candidates or office holders. And the Supreme Court just wiped that out, and we have a tsunami of corporate wealth that is now flooding into the political process and is going to dictate the direction of this country rather than the republic and the democracy. And that is a catastrophe for our country, and Obama has run up against that wall. You know, he passed it through Congress, but you have a Senate that essentially are a group of corporate toadies for coal and oil. They're the carbon cronies. And that's, you know, they're representing their interests rather than the interests of the American people. And, you know, Obama, it's not fair to say Obama has failed when, you know, the same thing with his health care. He's running up against the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical industry has under its control all of the news organizations. 70% of advertising on network news now comes from pharmaceutical companies. Do you think that they're going to support something that damages their interest? The rest of advertising is coming from the automobile industries and the oil industries. The reason that Air America failed was not because they didn't have listeners. They had more listeners. They were beating Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh in every market. They were the number one radio station in Republican, in San Diego, for example. It was a Republican town. So it wasn't listeners, it wasn't the hunger for progressive talk, it was that they could not get advertising. They were advertising, you know, hair products and penis enlargement and, you know, and these gold scam companies, you know, because they couldn't get national advertisers because they were boycotted by the pharmaceutical industry, the oil industry, the coal industry, and the auto, and oil, coal, all of the major national advertisers. And that happened because the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine by Ronald Reagan in 1988, where, you know, the media no longer has the obligation to serve the public interest. They're now serving their shareholders' interest. And they do that not by telling us the issues that we need to understand to make rational decisions in a democracy, but rather by entertaining us. So we're today, by appealing to the prurient interest that all of us have in the reptilian core of our brains for sex and celebrity gossip. So we know a lot about Charlie Sheen, and we know a lot about Britney Spears' gradual, you know, emotional decline, but we know very little about what's happening in Appalachia or about global warming or the things we need to know. We're the best entertained and least informed people on the face of the earth, and we cannot keep our international leadership or our democracy if we don't have an informed public that is capable of recognizing all the milestones of tyranny and telling the truth from fiction. You know, in Canada, they don't allow lying on television. It's illegal on the television news to lie. That's why Fox News is not in Canada. And that's why the Canadians didn't follow us into Iraq, into a, you know, an 800-year-old fistfight in Mesopotamia where Dick Cheney was saying, oh yeah, they're going to meet us with flowers in the streets. The Canadians were saying, are you crazy? Because they weren't listening to Fox News. And, you know, and the devolution of the American media and the lack of campaign finance, those are two legs of this, the three-legged stool of democracy that have folded in our country. And, you know, anybody who looks at American democracy can see we are in worse trouble now than we've ever been since the Gilded Age when this country was owned by corporations. And we have to understand this. That when business is controlled by government, it's called communism. When government is controlled by business, it's called fascism. And our job is to walk that narrow trail in between, keep big government at bay with our left hand, big business at bay with our right, and walk that narrow trail, which is free market capitalism and democracy. And in order to do that, we need a working press that is sophisticated, that is aggressive, and is determined to tell us the truth about issues, and we need an informed public that can recognize the milestones of tyranny, and we don't have that anymore in the United States of America.
That was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California in June 2011. My thanks to the Climate One Project for permission to rebroadcast this talk. Find out more at commonwealthclub.org. Download this and all our programs at ecoshock.org. We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening. From the event Live Earth, here's a bit of rap from the Black Eyed Peas.
It's hotter in the winter, even hotter in the summer. Jesus or Buddha, somebody come and help us out. Lord, come down and help us out. Send us an angel, help us out. SOS, help us out. I'm looking all around and I'm watching the world. Changing. Open up your eyes, you can see things rearranging. Cause baby, the world is dying. And if they say it's gonna be alright, then people are lying. When an Eskimo gets bit by a mosquito, somebody in Miami will get swept by a tsunami. Rasas in Jamaica will get hit by a quake that registered something like 7.8. You see, a situation's happening with our planet, cause 50 years ago we took it for granted. We should've took advantage and reversed the damage instead of just pumping and selling and slanging the gas. And while we purchased the gas, we was watching soap operas while they steady brainwashed the masses. Cause we can make a vehicle that runs off ashes, but they don't own a patent for that.